all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net.
I am your officer of the deck today, Lieutenant JG type. We have two great programs for you today that I think you'll truly enjoy. I know I did in talking to these individuals. We always want to remind you, you can find more about Veterans Radio at its Facebook site or by going to VeteransRadio.net, where we're on the web 24/7. You can find a lot of our podcasts there as well. We post new ones every Tuesday. And before we get started, we want to thank our sponsors. First up, we want to thank National Veteran Business Development Council, NVBDC.org. It was established to certify both service-disabled and veteran-owned businesses. You'll find out how they can help your business by going to NVBDC.org. We also want to thank Eisenhower Center. It's a brain injury recovery center. Learn more about EisenhowerCenter.com. They're located in Michigan and in Florida. We want to thank Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans fights for veterans' disability rights all across the nation. You can reach them at 800-693-4800 or on the web at LegalHelpForVeterans.com. Contact us if you'd like to be a sponsor on Veterans Radio, and let's move on to our program. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Deanne Bonner Simpson, a veterans disability lawyer with Legal Help for Veterans and who is the practice group leader. Deanne, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thanks, Jim. I'm glad to be here.
Well, we want to talk about some new presumptive conditions that VA has recognized relative to Agent Orange exposure. Tell us a little bit about the new presumptives.
Sure. The VA announced on May 27th that there are three new conditions they will consider under the presumptive service connection for Agent Orange exposure, which are bladder cancer, hypothyroidism, and Parkinsonism.
And what does the fact that these are now presumptive conditions mean?
So the VA has recognized certain areas where people have served where they know veterans were exposed to Agent Orange. And what that means is if service took place in Vietnam, the waters off of Vietnam, or Korea near the DMZ, and certain bases on Thailand, the VA just presumes you were exposed to Agent Orange, so you don't have to prove it. And you don't have to prove that there's a medical connection between the Agent Orange and those three conditions.
And that's really a big deal because it takes out having to have a doctor prove up that you had enough exposure to something to get this condition. When it's a presumptive condition, they said, well, if you were boots on the ground in Vietnam, we know you had enough exposure to Agent Orange that your Parkinsonism, which is going to be presumed to be caused by that exposure. So it really removes one of the big hurdles if you otherwise are qualified geographically, doesn't it?
Yes, normally a veteran would have to go out and prove that they were exposed to Agent Orange and then get a medical doctor to say that their exposure to Agent Orange was as likely as not the cause of these three conditions. But what this does for the veteran is just that they only have to show that they're currently diagnosed with this condition, and their service in those areas recognized by the VA does the rest. They're presumed to have been exposed to Agent Orange, and the VA is saying bladder cancer, hypothyroidism, and Parkinsonism are conditions that are known to be caused by Agent Orange.
I think we can all picture what bladder cancer is, and I think a lot of us have had exposure to folks who had Parkinson's. What is hypothyroidism? That's a big word that maybe you can break down a little bit for us.
Okay. So the hypothyroidism is a condition that affects a person's thyroid gland. And what happens is that the thyroid gland will not produce enough of certain hormones in the body, This can cause health problems in a person, such as obesity, joint pain, infertility, and heart disease.
Wow, so it can have an impact throughout the whole body system. That's pretty amazing stuff. Now, folks, Vietnam era guys who were exposed to Agent Orange had to fight for a long time to say, well, Agent Orange geographically was also in Korea or Thailand or elsewhere, so maybe that geographic argument's probably not done because the folks in Guam are arguing about it. But now these presumptives come up. Well, what if I made my argument, I was in Vietnam and I made my argument years ago that my bladder cancer was related to my Agent Orange exposure and VA said no. What do I do now?
So for Vietnam veterans specifically, there was a lawsuit back in 1991. It was a class action in a federal court in the Northern District of California, and it was called NEMER versus the Department of Veterans Affairs. What happened was the class action had a settlement, and the court ordered the VA to look back every time case there are new presumptive conditions added for Agent Orange exposure in Vietnam veterans, the VA has to look back at previously denied claims. In this case, it would be for these bladder cancer, hypothyroidism, and Parkinsonism. And if a veteran was previously denied, now the effective date can go back to that original date of claim because of this class action settlement. And I think something that's important for people to understand, too, if unfortunately a veteran has passed away since that time that the claim was filed, their surviving spouse, dependent, or children can step into the shoes of the veteran. And what's different in this case with the NEMER settlement is it expands that group of people who can step in for the veteran. Normally it would just be a surviving spouse or a dependent child, but now it can be a surviving spouse who at the time was married to the veteran but has gone on even maybe to marry a second time. Any child, parents, and if none of those people are available, then it would go to the estate of the veteran.
Well, that's a big deal, too, to make that it can go to the veteran's estate. That's a kind of a whole new thing, isn't it?
It's totally different from the regular service connection disability claim. Usually, it's only for the surviving spouse, if she's or he hasn't remarried, and dependent children only.
I had another question because you said this look back is for Vietnam vets in particular. What if I was at the Korean DMZ and had my exposure or a Thailand base exposure to Agent Orange and they denied my bladder cancer years ago, but now it's recognized the medical connection through this presumptive conditions? What do I have to do?
So as a Korean veteran who served by the DMZ, you would have to file a new claim. Unfortunately, the class action does not apply to veterans outside of the Vietnam geographical area and the waters outside of Vietnam. But you could submit your claim and point out to the VA. They already have evidence in the record that you've had bladder cancer. And they should proceed with the analysis as a presumptive condition.
And we'd want to remind all our veterans of this era, wherever you might have served or had the exposure, but we'll call it the Vietnam era. You know, you need to get moving. If they have questions, how do they get in contact with you, Deanne?
Well, anyone who has questions about this can give us a call at Legal Help for Veterans at 800-693-4800, and we'll be more than happy to speak with you about any questions. Again, that's 800-693-4800.
And would you remind our listeners what the website is?
It's www.legalhelpforveterans.com.
Well, we appreciate Deanne Bonner-Simpson taking some time today to talk to veteran radio listeners about these three new presumptive conditions to the list of Agent Orange exposure disability, and so that our veterans can think about, do they have an old claim they have to revive? Is there something that they should do? Did they never file because they just heard it they couldn't? But now there, maybe there's a new opportunity. So we thank you for coming in today, Deanne.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Before moving on to our interview with Dean Wegner, a U.S. Army veteran, West Point graduate who's got a cool business, we want to thank some of our sponsors. In particular, we want to thank our VSO sponsors. So Vietnam Veterans of America, Charles S. Kettles Chapter, 310, VFW Graf O'Hara Post, 423, and American Legion Prescon Post, 46, all in Ann Arbor. You can help support Veteran Radio as well. Go see us at veteransradio.net and contact us. And we want to remind you that one of our sponsors is U.S. Wings. They produce those really cool bomber jackets that the military uses. We're giving away a Top Gun Maverick jacket every month, so check in on that as well and check them out at uswings.com. Let's move on and hear from Dean. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Dean Wegner. Dean is the brains behind the creator of Authentically American. And it's a long time anybody's called him the brains behind something, I can tell. But we have him on today as a spotlight on National Veteran Business Development Council, NVBDC.org. Veterans Radio America has a relationship with NVBDC.org, which is the nation's leading third-party authority for certification of veteran-owned businesses of all sizes. The 501c3 nonprofit was established in 2013 and addressed the growing need to identify and certify both service-disabled and veteran-owned businesses in governmental and commercial or corporate marketplace. NVBDC administers a rigorous certification process designed to withstand the scrutiny of governmental and corporate entities seeking to utilize certified veteran-owned businesses. Dean, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Well, Jim, I'm honored to be a guest, and I did get a laugh when he said the brains behind Authentically American.
Well, part of the reason he laughed about that, folks, is he's a graduate of the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, and he flew helicopters and was in the Army for a number of years. And so, you know, some of those brains probably got beat out of him, and he went to West Point to play hockey, which also explains a lot. The only thing worse is if he had been a goalie there or so.
We didn't go that far, Jim, but we have been hitting the head a few times. Yeah. It's been an incredible journey, starting from West Point all the way through my 7 years active duty with Flight School, Ranger School, and what I'm doing now with Authentically American. So I'm looking forward to our coffee discussion here.
Well, tell us a little bit, tell our Veteran Radio listeners a little bit about Authentically American and what its expertise in the apparel industry is.
Absolutely, Jim. And Authentically American, we are a veteran-owned, American-made premium apparel brand, and our vision, Jim, is to build this iconic American brand that's truly American-made. And if you think of brands like Nike or Under Armour or Lands End or Polo, they are all iconic in their own right, but not a single one of them, Jim, is American-made. And we're passionate about job creation. And to give you some historical context, when I graduated from West Point in 1993, over 50% of the apparel in the U.S. is made in the U.S., and today, Jim, it's less than 3%.
Yeah,
that is all that's made here.
It's a shocking number, and it's, you know, I guess probably most people would say, is anything really made, any apparel really made in the U.S. anymore? How is that, competition or ability to even find craftsmen who can do the work that you want to do?
Well, Jim, it is not easy, but I will tell you, last year, in the middle of a global pandemic and having contract manufacturers across the U.S. in 12 states, there's not a lot of them, but the ones that are there, they are amazing. And I wish, Jim, we were here in person instead of via phone, via radio, because if you could touch and feel our T-shirts and how soft they are, if you could see, you know, the performance polos that we have, or if you could wear the socks, you'd say to yourself, Dean, I know they're American-made, but more importantly, these are just amazing products. I mean, they're just phenomenal. And that's why, first and foremost, we reinforce our products. It's important to be American-made, but as a consumer brand, we love to highlight that our products are amazing. Forget where they're made. They are just incredible products. But that really stems from our belief in the American worker, the backbone of our country.
Well, I think everybody's always been willing to pay a little bit more for quality, and that's really what you're talking about, isn't it?
It is, but that's one thing we have battled a little bit, Jim, because the initial stereotype, the initial premise that people have is that it's American-made. It must be outrageously expensive, and that's not true. If you go to our website, authenticallyamerican.us, and look at the consumer brand or collegiate side, we are very competitively priced, and that's an intentional choice. So if you're used to buying a Nike polo or your business is partnering with Lands End and you want to partner with us, what you will say likely is two things. One is, again, amazing product, but number two, you're very competitively priced.
And we're going to talk some more about the business itself, but why was it important to be certified as a veteran-owned business by NVBDC?
There is really two reasons, Jim. One, you know, I had such an incredible, you know, 7 years after my 4 years at West Point, just love the opportunity to serve my country. And the incredible men and women I served with, that led us to an intentional choice to donate 10% of our profits to veteran and first responder charities. And over my business career, I've heard a lot of times that people want to partner with veteran-owned businesses, but it was always a challenge because, unfortunately, there's too much fraud and deception out there, and people were playing games and trying to masquerade as a veteran business when they had never served. And that's what I love, what the entire team at the NVBDC has done. Keith King and Amy Applewhite and the entire crew, I mean, they have built something truly special so that if you are a business, especially one of those large Fortune 500 businesses who have a lot of dollars to spend, and you want to work with an authentically veteran-owned businesses, NVBDC now makes that possible for you to do that and not have any concern whether it is legitimate.
And really, you don't have to be a Fortune 500 company to be certified,
no.
But you get this networking and involvement with those kinds of companies. Did you think maybe you were too small to get certified and realize any of these networking benefits, or did you feel when you started this process that, hey, I'm right in the sweet spot and this is going to help me grow?
Well, Jim, I absolutely feel that we're in the sweet spot, and the reference to Fortune 500 was those companies that are buying or want to buy from veteran-owned businesses. That was really the context there. And, you know, we are a small, moving into a middle market company. And we love it when we have an opportunity to partner with those bigger companies. So I've never felt that we were too small. I felt that this was just a great platform and an opportunity to highlight something that I believe in, and that's being a veteran-owned business.
During your certification process, tell us about how rigorous it was and how comfortable you are that everybody else who's certified is equally legitimate.
Well, Jim, after the process, I was exhausted. So... And it was not something that was overbearing, but it to me was at the right level because, you know, they look into DD 214 and all the official documentation that says I served. And then there was also a visit that came from, you know, the general that came out and spent time with us at our office in Nashville, got to meet me, got to meet my team, and understand and realize that, you know, we are a legitimate business. So it was the right touch of, you know, online data submissions, paperwork to validate that, but then also in-person visit to make sure that it was a legitimate business.
Well, I think that's one of the unique things about NVBDC is not only are they certifying you, but they are working towards helping you be successful by hopefully creating some opportunities to sell to those major companies. Have any of those opportunities worked out for you?
They are right now. And to your point, that's one thing I love, Jim, about NVBDC is it wasn't the push to get us certified and then they move on. You know, we have continued to maintain a relationship. And the fact that you and I are talking right now is a testament to that. You know, I've continued to keep in touch with Keith King and Amy Applewhite, and you know, they've heard a lot of the great work that we are doing. And one of the ones I'm most excited about is a number of the charities and nonprofits that are also veteran focused that partner with NVBDC because they are going to be new clients of ours. And the reason, Jim, I'm so excited about this is we as a company are passionate about giving back. And we play that out two ways. Number one, We very intentionally donate 10% of our profits to veteran and first responder charities. But in this context, the important one I want to highlight is when we partner with a charity or nonprofit, we provide our goods and services at cost. So you're getting amazing American-made product, and this provides you an opportunity as a charity to build your brand and help raise some money in the process.
Well, a great giving back, and I think you can't find a better testimonial than Dean Wegner with Authentically American NVBDC and the value of being certified by that group. We have up the full interview with Dean Wegner and more talk about his business, Authentically American.us, on our podcast. So go to veteransradio.net, click on the blog talk button, and go listen to the whole thing when you have a chance. But before we go on and talk about a recent Medal of Honor recipient from the Korean War and the gentleman who helped shepherd or was the medical Medal of Honor Sherpa, as I refer to him, a few more words from one of our sponsors. And
military veterans touch everyone's life. I'm guessing right now you're thinking of a veteran, a close friend, relative. Maybe it's you. Even the toughest of us sometimes need help but don't know where to turn for support. You don't need special training to help a veteran in your life. Even small actions can make a world of difference. If you know a veteran in crisis, please call the Veterans Crisis Line, 800-273-8255. 800-273-8255. A message from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
Now that we have all of our Army veterans standing at attention for their rousing march, we want to bring you a story about a Korean War veteran who was recently provided the Medal of Honor. It's Colonel Ralph Puckett, sort of the grandfather of the Army Rangers. But we're going to tell the story a little differently, as we like to do here on Veterans Radio, and we're going to tell it from the viewpoint of the gentleman who kind of made it his life mission to get Colonel Puckett's medal upgraded to the Medal of Honor. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Lieutenant Colonel John Locke, retired U.S. Army, and we're going to talk about the most recent Medal of Honor recipient, Colonel Ralph Puckett, who was 94 years old when he received the Medal of Honor. He was given it to him by President Biden in May of 2021. Colonel, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Well, Jim, thank you very much. I appreciate you having me on.
Well, let me just set this up so that our listeners understand you're kind of the real deal, and then we'll get to the story. But as I mentioned, you retired from active duty as a lieutenant colonel. You served for 28 years from 1974 to 2002. You went to the West Point. Got your BS in electrical engineering and computer science, and you picked up a master's degree in operational research and statistics from Rensselaer Polytech Institute. So, you know, you're kind of a smart guy here, but you were in the Army.
I fool a lot of people.
Yeah. And some people might say, wait a minute, how can you say that he was in the Army? John, tell us about the events that led up to Ralph Puckett receiving the Medal of Honor.
Well, as you noted, it was a little bit of a journey, an odyssey to say the least. About 18 years in the making. Upon reflection, we were driving down to the Medal of Honor ceremony the other week. I was going over it with my wife, and it dawned on me. I was trying to figure out exactly what the impetus was that set this all off. I obviously had written a book on Ranger history, and I'd literally, embarrassingly, stumbled across the Battle of Hill 205 and then Lieutenant Puckett. And I consider myself a relatively knowledgeable military historian in a number of things, but I was not aware of this. And also, as a fellow graduate in West Point, it was kind of embarrassing. So I decided I wanted to look into it some more. And in the process of writing the book, I reached out to Colonel Puckett at that time. This is in the early 90s, and he was very generous in the sense of providing me materials that I could use to write the chapter associated with the Korean Rangers, 8th Army Ranger Company. And so that had placed in the back of my mind the fact that there's more to this story here. This is it's not the downplay by any stretch of the imagination. It's a Distinguished Service Cross, the second highest award, of which he has two of them. For years, I just kept thinking that there was more, that there's more to this. I had an opportunity to speak with, at that time, it was Colonel Stan McChrystal, who's the regimental commander of 75th Regiment. But I had that opportunity to talk with Colonel McChrystal. He agreed that it was a Medal of Honor worthy in his own mind. So that was there in the back. And finally, around 2003, had an opportunity to put together a packet for. But at that time, I realized, why not take this the next step? I had just retired a couple years prior and was in the process of doing other writing and research and such. And finally, I just said to myself, I've already taken it this far. Let's take this baby around the road, around the neighborhood a couple times for a spin. Let's see what we can do with it. And so that really was the impetus. That's what started the journey and the quest to secure for him an upgrade for the Medal of Honor.
Well, tell us about what the Battle of Hill 205 was about in Korea back in November of 1950.
Well, the interesting thing with the battle, and this is what I was looking to get conveyed in the comments from President Biden, was that the battle really started before Hill 205. Here we have a brand new second lieutenant. You know, anyone who served, and certainly anybody who's been in a leadership position as a junior officer, as a junior NCO, can appreciate what it is trying to motivate and bring a unit together. And in this instance, you have a brand new second lieutenant out of West Point. All he has is a little bit of infantry schooling from Benning. And he goes over, he volunteers for, and next thing he knows, he's assigned as the company commander to raise his eighth, this novel 8th Army Ranger Company, first Ranger unit to be brought to active duty post World War II. And he has two classmates or his platoon leaders, and he's only allowed to bring on board non-combat, non-infantry type of individuals. And so he's soliciting and interviewing all sorts of, clerks, cooks, drivers, mechanics. I mean, everybody who's not skilled at all in carrying a rifle. And then he has to take and put together. He not only personally handpicks and selects each and every individual. And by his own admission, later on, he had indicated, I had every type of Dash American that there was, every type of ethnicity. He also brought on board two African Americans, who, again, which is really rather novel, given the fact that Truman had only desegregated the military a year or two prior to that. So, again, he was just looking for two things from these people. Are you passionate, motivated enough to learn what needs to be learned, and or are you willing to follow me? And so that was primarily his criteria. And then he led by example. He put together a training regimen that he initially had been told he has 7 weeks to execute, but he ended up with only about 5.5 weeks. So, again, he's taken from scratch these individuals and training them, forging them into a relatively elite, certainly for that time frame, light infantry unit. And so now you move that forward to Thanksgiving weekend of 1950. And he's assigned the Ranger Company is assigned to an armored task force. And so the day before they actually had a fight, they took another hill, Hill 224. And in the process of doing that, they endured not only some casualties to enemy fire, but they also endured fratricide. American tanks, the tanks they were riding into battle on ended up firing on them and killed three Rangers. They get on top of the hilltop. They dig in at night. It's about 0 degrees. They have no food, no hot, no cold weather gear. And so now you're asked the very next morning, the 25th of November, to go ahead and attack Hill 205. And so you're already relatively fried. You've already attacked one hill the day before. You've suffered KIAs, killed in action in the process. You spent a miserable night. You've had individuals who hypothermia and frostbite. They actually lost a couple Rangers, so had to go back because of frostbite and hypothermia. Total sleep deprivation. Now they're asked to take Hill 205. And so the whole process there was riding into battle, taking the base of the hill. And during that time, Colonel Puckett exposed himself on three different occasions, running across the field so they could identify and locate where an enemy machine gun was that was stopping the advance. And so they were to eliminate the machine gun. So he placed himself at risk there, his life at risk doing that three different times. They take the hill. And finally, later on that night is when the battle occurs, starting around 10 o'clock, about 2,200 hours. Again, same thing. They're digging into frozen ground. And now it's actually even colder because you now have a chill factor from a pretty stiff wind coming in. So it's probably around minus 20 minimum. And now you're enduring an attack from a force that outnumbers you about 10 to 1. And so for the first five assaults, they were able to repel. The colonel was able to call in continuous artillery support. And he actually was wounded in the thigh with a grenade fragment in the left thigh in the first wave of attack and refused to be extracted off the hill. Later on, he was wounded again in the left shoulder. During another attack, so he has a second set of wounds, and he's still moving around. He's calling in danger close fire. Another episode, there was a Chinese sniper, enemy sniper, approximately 20 or so meters away, and taking pot shots at his guy. So he called out, "Okay, I'm going to do my bit here," and he runs once. The sniper shoots at him, and they shoot at the sniper and miss. He runs the second time. Same thing happens, and he says, as he relates the story, he says, "Okay, I called out to my guys the third time. You better get him this time because I'm not running anymore."
This is part of the story that I think, again, it's sort of hard to put yourself back 70 years where the technology was different, no technology, that the mm-hmm. the equipment was different. In Korea in particular, the lack of cold weather gear, these guys literally froze to death in some instances. And he's running across the rice paddies, the frozen rice paddies, and I think I read somewhere it's like 800 yards, zigging mm-hmm. and zagging, trying to draw fire so that his guys nowhere to return fire. I mean, you just it's hard to think that a man would put himself in that position, but it was the only way to advance his troops and advance their safety. It's an incredible part of the story.
Well, it is. And in reality, when I went back to look at the DSC, the Distinguished Service Cross Citation, there were a couple of incidents like that were missing from it. And again, those are the kind of events that highlight the risk of life that should be emphasized. And so that actually was one of a number of things I ended up putting in there to, bring it up to, if we want to say, bring it up to a Medal of Honor, or at least have it identified as a Medal of Honor event. And so, but yeah, you just picture again, he does this again for the sniper later on, and he's running with a wounded leg. he's already taken some shrapnel in the thigh, so he's not exactly at full speed when he's doing this. And at the same time, he's redistributing ammunition. And this is the other highlight that is really stunning. You think about it. As I said, they're outnumbered by about 500-600 man battalion against their 50-some Rangers. And he's given away his ammo. He gave away all of his ammo except for one 8-round clip, to ensure that his Rangers could continue to fight. And so finally on the sixth and final assault, which was around 2:20, 2:30 in the morning, that stage of the game, about 4.5 hours into the battle, that was, again, the other thing to keep in mind here is that while this event is ongoing on Hill 205, the entire 8th Army is getting its butt waxed, just soundly beaten across the entire front, because that's when the Chinese, Communist Chinese, came over. Even though it had been known that they were in the area, they kind of acted as though it was a surprise, had not anticipated or planned for it as well as they should have upon reflection. And so you end up with about 500,000, 600,000 Chinese now hitting the 8th Army. And so you have units all along the front being overrun. And so the artillery that had been supporting the Rangers was shifted elsewhere. And so by the time that final assault came, there was no artillery fire to be able to call in. And that was when Lieutenant Puckett was in his foxhole attempting to call in. He was begging, essentially, artillery, we're being overrun. We need the fires. And that's when two mortar rounds came in and they detonated right behind him and peppered his entire body, primarily on the left side and the soles of his feet with shrapnel. And his right foot was damaged so badly that he actually had to spend about the next 6 or 8 months convincing the surgeons not to amputate it. It was that badly damaged.
And let's remind people here, and we're talking to Colonel John Locke about the exploits of Colonel then Lieutenant Ralph Puckett in Korea in 1950. But let's remind people here, John, there's no air support. If there's no artillery, there's no support. It's just you and on one side of the hill and the Chinese on the other, right? There's no air support here.
Yeah, I mean, that was it. It was nothing but their carbine rifles. The few had pistols. If you had a BAR, a couple machine guns, and hand grenades, and obviously the bayonet, because it did come down to the bayonet and hand-to-hand close quarters combat for a number of the Rangers when they finally got overrun.
Odds of the Chinese become overwhelming, there's a decision that has to be made to evacuate the area. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, there was. At that stage, obviously, everything, as you'd indicated, there's no support. There's no close air support. Now there's no artillery support, so everybody's on their own. They're already a lot of the guys had already run low or if not out of ammunition, and so you end up with again a lot of close quarters combat going on. A lot of reports of a number of individuals took a last stand and were facing the enemy literally with a bayonet in their hands. And so at that stage, Colonel Puckett had Lieutenant Puckett had just been able, he was able to get himself out of the foxhole just barely. He'd indicated he tried to stand up and run, and he dropped to his knees after the first step or two, totally exhausted, and the injuries prevented him from even moving. And so he had indicated that, he's just watching Chinese soldiers about 10, within 10 meters or so of him, 10 yards, killing and bayoneting his Rangers, and he couldn't do anything about it. And it just so happened that a Ranger, one of his PFC Rangers came by him. He had lost his weapon in the battle, so he wasn't armed at the time. And Colonel Puckett, Lieutenant Puckett said, leave me behind. And that was PFC Judy. And he went down the hill, but he didn't just leave him behind. He ran. He encountered two other PFC Rangers, PFC Walls and Pollock, and indicated to him that the commander was back up the hill. And, he needed help. And so those two charged back up. They were armed, still had some bullets. And so they literally charged back up the hill, knowing what they were facing, and came upon the lieutenant there. They killed three Chinese soldiers in the area. And then one of them picked him up, and while the other provided covering fire as they tried to move him down the hill. And they could only carry him for about 300-400 meters. They had to get back down that hill because it's a slope. It's not 205 indicates it's 205 meters high, but you're going on the angle, the hypotenuse of the right triangle there. So you're covering a lot more distance than the 205 meters, and you're also being shot at,
and you're almost out of ammunition, and there's no support.
You are, yeah. And apparently, when they did come up to get him. That was the second time that he said, save yourselves, leave me behind. But they refused. They picked him up. They took him down. They got to a small ravine and they took inventory there, and they literally were no longer had any ammunition left. And they had one grenade, and they apparently all three of them kind of made a pact that we're not going to be captured. This grenade will come in handy to take care of us. At that stage, Lieutenant Puckett for a third time told his men to leave him behind. And they refused to do that. So he said, okay, fine, put me on my back and just drag me down the hill by my arms. And that's what they did. They drug him down, and he was suffering such pain. The joke was that, he kept muttering to himself, I'm a Ranger, trying to keep from yelling out in the pain. And finally, even in the end, he still was doing his job. as a commander to ensure that the enemy paid a heavy price for what they had just done to him and his Rangers.
So let me also give some background color to this. Ralph Puckett served for 22 years, well beyond Korea. He actually saw combat in Vietnam when he retired in 1971. He had two Distinguished Service Crosses.
So he literally established and created and established the Ranger Standard. And he had the opportunity to be assigned when he came back to the States and is recovering from his wounds. The infancy of the U.S. Army Ranger School. The course was just being started then, and he was one of the initial cadre. And so the standards that the school espouses today are primarily those very same standards that Colonel Puckett had created back with the 8th Army Ranger Company to train them. So the Ranger standards start there.
Well, it really shows you the impact one man with dedication and passion can give to his community. And we're talking about Colonel Ralph Puckett, recipient of the Medal of Honor. What I want to do now, John, we're talking to Lieutenant Colonel John Locke, retired. I want to turn to the Medal of Honor ceremony that you had the opportunity to attend for Colonel Puckett, because I don't think many folks ever kind of get to have that experience, and maybe what leads up to it a little bit, and sort of, I can't even imagine what that day is like, that you're not, you know, bursting out with pride for your friend and colleague here. So tell us a little bit about that whole White House ceremony that maybe the general public doesn't see.
I mean, there are obviously, quite obviously, there's a lot of background motion in terms of coordination. And it makes it even more difficult when it's under the time of COVID. Quite obviously, you know, it's the first Medal of Honor ceremony for President Biden to do as president. And we're under, some aspects of COVID restrictions. And what that did is that restricted some of the numbers that we could bring in there. But we went without the masks, but we were tested prior to – I went a year and a half without – I had COVID way back February before last. I've had my shots. I went all this time without having my nose done, and I had to get the swab for this. But it was well worth it. But there's a tremendous amount, as you can appreciate, you know, the White House, the Department. It's actually led by the service, whichever service the recipient is. In this case, it was Department of Army. And so the DA led a vast majority of the coordination efforts. They're really the escorts for everything until they get to the White House. And then in the White House, they take over. But the Department of Defense primarily takes the lead on all this type of stuff. And the DA, Department of Army G1, led by Lieutenant General Gary Brito, they were stellar. They were just exceptionally supportive of everything that we needed, everything that I needed to get done in terms of laying things out, getting orders, his uniform squared away. And I mean, literally his uniform spans three wars. He was a cadet at the end of the Second World War. So he was World War II. He has a Victory Medal in there. He's Korea and he's Vietnam. So he spanned three wars. And so, we're able to put all that together. And this man was so humble. He would not even wear the Special Forces tab because it came into existence after he retired. And when I asked him about that, I said, okay, we're going to get this fixed. So we immediately got the orders cut for him. So you'll see now he's wearing the green. And you sit here and you think, in the Army, you want a CIB, Combat Infantry Badge, you want a Ranger tab, you want a Special Forces tab. I mean, if you can have those things, and here this man, he did not wear his Combat Infantry Badge after Korea for a while because he didn't have orders for it. He didn't wear the Special Forces tab because he didn't have orders for it. It's just amazing how humble and sincere this guy is. But the ceremony itself is exceptionally unique. Obviously, the recipient and in this case here, his wife are taken care of and managed by Department of Defense. They handled everything, though in this instance there also was a friend an associate who provided them private transportation coming up to D.C., which was very nice. Didn't have to fly commercial air for that. And so came in, they put you up in a hotel, and the vision, you know, the Sheraton overlooking the Pentagon area and overlooking D.C., it's right next to Arlington. Just an amazing view in terms of sitting there and looking out. And so, you know, we arrived in on that was on Wednesday. And then Thursday, he had an opportunity to visit with the Pentagon and meet Secretary of the Army, Chief of Staff of the Army, and have lunch and such with them while everyone else, the family and close friends, had an opportunity to tour the Pentagon and certain aspects of it. Came back, had a media day event for an hour or so set up, had an opportunity for him to make remarks there and answer some questions. And then the next day, you know, you start off, you go to the White House, and again, how they treat a recipient or the family associated with them, you get literally, it's as though you're treating you as if you're the president of the United States in terms of putting you in a convoy, police escorts. You don't stop. You go through all the lights. I mean, it's a nice experience to observe and to be part of from the inside. You got to the White House, and the recipients go in through the front, so to say, and we end up going in. We did our swab testing and verification of all that stuff, and then we went into the East Wing and, you know, had an opportunity there to visit a number of the rooms. Now, anyone who does have an opportunity to go to the White House, I've had a few of the other type of tours. Obviously, this tour is significantly different in the sense of how deep you get into the White House on this one, and the opportunity just really kind of roam around. And the White House is an exceptional – it is a national treasure. It is a museum. Every room is a museum piece. That's the other neat thing. Every president has an opportunity to reach out to the Smithsonian Institute and take whatever he wants, he or she wants.
well, borrow, not take. Yeah, borrow.
Well, yeah. Correct. I stand corrected. I did not use precise terms precisely. Yes, they have an opportunity to borrow whatever it is that they wish to borrow and put them down there. So you're looking at swords and from George Washington and China from Lincoln and, you know, everyone else. And so time for the ceremony. Go upstairs and you walk into the lobby area, and you really have to, you know, certainly encourage anybody to take a look at the layout of the White House before, if you have an opportunity to go, so you know where you're at in relation to everything. And when you picture a president walking in and making a speech or an event ongoing in the East Room, you can put it into perspective, having seen some of this stuff earlier. You know, the stairs that the president walks down from the residence up in the second
floor. I'm going to take it, John, and I would expect nothing less, but the ceremony and the handling of this, even the media handling of this, is as dignified as it should be for somebody who's being recognized for the Medal of Honor. I thank you for the insight into the ceremony and how you Sherpa this through. John, thanks a lot for your time today.
Well, Jim, I appreciate your time and the opportunity to spread his story.
This is Dale Thronberry from Veterans Radio with an important announcement for you, our loyal listeners. In partnership with U.S. Wings, we are bringing back our monthly flight jacket giveaway. Beginning right now, you can win a Top Gun Maverick flight jacket. This is U.S. Wings' recreation of the exact CWU jacket worn in the upcoming Top Gun 2 Maverick movie. It is made from military-grade satin nylon. The patches on the jacket are authentic military patches supplied to Paramount Pictures for the Top Gun movie. This jacket could be yours. All you have to do is register to win. Go to veteransradio.net, click on the flight jacket, and register to be in the drawing to win this month's Top Gun flight jacket. The winner will be announced on our monthly benefits program, which is the last program of each month. Don't miss out on your chance to win this incredible U.S. Wings Top Gun flight jacket. Go to veteransradio.net and register now.
We're talking today with our new amateur historian here on Veterans Radio, Joe Neusendorfer. Joe, welcome to Veterans Radio, and tell us a little bit about yourself.
My interest in military slang stems from my service as a USA Air Force veteran.
Well, you got a few different phrases for us today to remind our veteran radio listeners of what this military slang is about. Why don't you start with grunts?
Okay, the first area I'd like to cover is military grunts versus pogs. And there's always been a lively rivalry amongst all branches of the U.S. military. One branch of service is pitted against another in football games and other rivalry sports competitions. However, there's a constant non-sports rivalry within each branch of service. It is who are on the ground workers versus who are the brain workers, or brawn versus brain. The brawn guys and gals are referred to as grunts, those who are out there on the front line, usually the infantry in the Army. Grunts bear the burden of the combat, kicking in doors and facing the enemy head on. They are subject to the highest risk. The brain guys, gals, are referred to as POGs, P-O-G-S. This meaning, in military talk, person other than a grunt. It has often become a derogatory term or insult of some sort. To put things in proper perspective, however, for an effective operating military, it takes both grunts and POGs working together. What all servicemen and women should remember is that combat missions are carried out because of the part each one plays, such as maintenance of the jets ensures the performance of a mission. The building of bridges and clearing of IEDs helps facilitate carrying out of the infantry role. Before a missile reaches its final destination, several hands played a part. You can't fight the enemy without ammunition transport to the fight or indirect fire from air support. So let's give a vigorous Veterans Radio shout out and salute to both grunts and POGs that are all doing their part to keep us safe.
Well, Joe, and I think, you know, anybody who's been in the service, you also realize that sometimes you're a grunt and sometimes you're a POG.
Double duty.
Yeah, based on your assignment. In my experience, this has always been kind of in good fun, hasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It's no insult intended on any part. It's all tongue-in-cheek.
Well, if you know, I think in the civilian world, they might have figured out what a grunt was, that ground pounder who's doing the work, busting down the doors. But now right. you've enlightened them about what POGs are. So I think some of them may want to be recognized as a POG in their organization. So great little update on some military slang for our veteran radio listeners. Joe, I'd like to have you turn to another term that you sometimes hear. Certainly in the military, we understand it, but I don't think they do in the civilian world. Scrambled eggs.
Yeah, scrambled eggs. That's interesting. It's a military slang term for the typically leaf-shaped embellishments found on the visors of peaked caps worn by military officers. The phrase is derived from the resemblance that the emblems have to scrambled eggs, particularly when the embellishments are golden colored. In the United States Armed Forces, scrambled eggs is the nickname for the golden oak leaf and acorn embellishments known as fretting on the bills or visors of frame service and dress uniform caps. Called service caps in the Army, combination covers in the Navy and Coast Guard, barracks covers in the Marine Corps, and so on, that are worn by field grade and general officers in the rank and grade of major or higher in the Army and the Marine Corps, and senior and flag officers in the rank and grade of commander or higher in the Navy and Coast Guard. In the U.S. Air Force, the embellishments on caps are silver, not gold. They are referred to as sparks, farts, and darts, lightning bolts, clouds, and arrows. The reason for the blue, the silver, is the uniforms are blue, and it just really blends in.
Well, again, this is one of those things that anybody who's probably watched a TV show has seen a military cap with a bunch of coloration. Those are the scrambled eggs right on the black bill, generally. Didn't maybe understand what those were, but as you move up the ranks, your gold oak leaf and acorn embellishments get a little more pronounced, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely, and especially you see them when they come in for congressional testimony and stuff on C-SPAN, they're their full dress uniform, the generals, and they got their scrambled eggs all over them.
Well, and it's, you know, from somebody who has risen through the ranks, it's quite a distinguishing feature. But what it also helps, and I think a lot of people don't understand this, is all of these military symbols and embellishments and things are in part so that you can recognize the rank that person may play from distance as you approach.
Exactly. And especially with the saluting of officers, they get a heads up that somebody's coming along the line that they need to salute.
That's right. Don't tick off a general or an admiral by not recognizing what, you know, what their rank is, right?
Exactly.
Respecting the rank. And I didn't realize that in the Air Force it was sparks, farts, and darts. You know, slang, Joe Neusendorf, an Air Force veteran, for spending a little time with us today and reminding us of some of these slang terms and certainly some of the culinary delights that that the veterans get, military men get to, and women get to experience around the world.
Thank you. It's a real joy being on your show, Jim.
Well, we certainly hope you enjoyed today's show. We brought you a lot of different information. We think that keeping you informed of what's going on at VA with the presumptive conditions is important, but also introducing you to veteran-owned businesses like AuthenticallyAmerican.us so that you can support other veterans. And the inside story on a Medal of Honor, how that package moves forward, what the ceremony's like, and actually the exploits of Colonel Ralph Puckett, the most recent Medal of Honor recipient. So, and you always got to get a chuckle out of some of the military slang. So we appreciate Joe Neusendorf for joining us for that as well. So reach out to us on Facebook at Veterans Radio. Look at us at veteransradio.net. We always appreciate your comments. Give us some show ideas. We're working with some new co-hosts that'll bring some new ideas to the table. And until next time on Veterans Radio, you are dismissed.